Hey, Talk Shop fans, I have a very exciting announcement. Join me and Fenimore Lane at the Mayflower Inn and Spa in Washington, Connecticut for a celebration of design on Saturday, May 18th. Journey to the countryside to shop our all-day design bazaar with two tents and over 30 amazing vendors in the home, fashion, and lifestyle space. Or take part in our design summit with one-of-a-kind panels and speakers, including Talk Shop Season 2 guest Annie Myers-Shire of This Oak House, in conversation with me and Farrow & Ball's color expert. Feel free to bring the kids and come hungry. Danry has children's activities covered, and Lee Jofa will be hosting a beautiful picnic by the pond. It's sure to be magical, and there's no time to wait. We already sold out of our all-day passes, so to learn more and pick up your tickets, visit the link in the show notes or via my Instagram bio. I hope to see you all there.
As I started working more with creators, it really brought back my childhood of growing up with a single mother who, she's a potter. You know, when I was like 10, 12 years old, we'd like put on prairie dresses and go to these weird little shows to sell her ceramics, and seeing how hard it was for her to sell her own things. I didn't realize until the past 5 years how much of that is my mission too, to help creators, like how much it means to me to help other people get their things out into the world.
Welcome to Talk Shop. I'm Ariel Oaken, a New York-based interior designer, writer, and editor looking to bring a little bit of magic into our homes every day. After years as a writer and editor in the interiors world, I founded my own editorial site, Fenimore Lane, in 2020, and the Talk Shop interview series was born. Each week, I delve into the personal experiences of the top interior designers and tastemakers around the globe. Join us this week as we dive into design history with Emily Evans Erdmans. Emily is the founder of Erdmans, a fine and decorative arts gallery and consultancy in New York City. Her most recent book, Mario Buada, Anatomy of a Decorator, is now available. Close friend of Mario's, Emily oversaw the dispersal of his estate, including the blockbuster auction of the Prince of Shintz's prized possessions at Sotheby's. Emily's book presents the key learnings and decorative history of Buada, one of America's most famous interior decorators. Along with Anatomy of a Decorator, Emily has also authored a long list of books, including monographs on Madeleine Castaing and Henri Samuel. With a master's degree in fine and decorative arts from Sotheby's in London, Emily has taught design history at FIT and the New York School of Interior Design. Please join me as we welcome Emily to the podcast. Emily, thank you so much for joining the podcast. I'm so excited to have you here.
Oh my gosh, Ariel, it is such a treat to be here with you.
Well, to kick off the conversation, if you could describe your style in three words or less.
I would say collected, classical, and I would say either colorful or maximalist, one of the two. It's hard to choose between those two, but exuberant.
Oh, I love colorful because I love the alliteration.
Oh, you're right. Okay. Yes, definitely colorful.
I was watching your Quintessence interview, and that gorgeous aubergine color on the walls is just stunning. So I think the colorful is perfect.
Oh my God. And that was a color that Mario had, and a glazing treatment that Mario had used over and over again. And I always coveted it. And so I hired his painter, Vincent, to do just that one room. It was the only room I could afford. And it's just gorgeous. And there's, you know, everybody back in the 80s, 90s used to glaze rooms where it would be coats and coats and just color going through color. And people don't really do that anymore, but it really is worth the investment. It really is different than just a color paint.
It lends itself to such a richer pigment on the wall, I think, and it's a lost art. So I was blown away by that. I thought it was so beautiful.
Yes, everyone needs to hire Vincent to just keep it going. Keep
We talk a lot about that on the podcast, just the art of all of these vendors in our industry who have these really specialized and specific talents, and how we should talk about them more and keep it alive.
Yes.
And that kind of ties into my next question for you, which is, for those who may not know, can you tell us a little bit about yourself as a design historian and where you are at this point in your career and kind of how you got there?
So I used to dread questions like this, you know, what is the elevator pitch for myself? Because I've always done so many different things, but I feel like it's really coming together and that I can answer it more succinctly. So I am a design historian. I have a master's in fine and decorative arts from Sotheby's Institute in London. And after completing that course, I really needed to start working again because I had spent a few years after college being an au pair in Paris. And that's where I discovered my love of decorative arts, living there for a few years. But it was time to get to work. And so I had really connected with the love of furniture, English 18th century furniture in particular, while I was in London. And so I worked for a dealer in New York, Hyde Park Antiques, for the next decade. And it was while working there that I wrote my first book, which was actually for the gallery on 18th century English furniture. And it was the book on sort of connoisseurship and the different historical styles of the 18th century that I wish I had had when I was studying. And that began this path of writing about historical style subjects. And as I continued, and as I worked at that gallery for 10 years, it was I like a lot more than just English 18th century. I really like the 20th century. I'm sort of just getting into the 21st century now. But my next book was Regency Redux, which was primarily focused on the continuation of classicism in the 20th century and really drilling down into the interwar years of all the different movements of classicism. So there's Art Deco, which is definitely very consciously looking back at the last true historical style, which was the Empire and late neoclassicism in France, Swedish Grace, so all these movements. And that was born out of starting to teach. I was teaching at FIT historical style classes. And I realized when you study the 20th century in school, in design school, you are only taught about modernism. You're not taught about how all of these more classical, how the classical canon is actually continuing. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't just stop with Art Deco or Swedish Grace or Hollywood Regency, which actually was when I wrote Regency Redux. Kelly Wurstler wrote the foreword, and she was having her big Hollywood Regency moment.
I have that book.
Oh my God. Thank you so much. Hey, Jonathan Adler was really big on the scene for not just his ceramics anymore, but he really was playing up that look. And I wanted to show that in my research, I would go to the New York Public Library and just call up decades of old issues of Vogue, House and Garden, and just go through them. And you would see how the people, the stylish people of all these decades, how they were living. And some people were living in a very modern way, but most weren't. Most were living in this kind of stripped down version of neoclassicism that felt very, very modern, but it was still classical. Mm-hmm. So that has kind of been that's where my interests lie. And the first book I did with Mario, which came out in 2013, I never helped anybody write a book before. And it was never something I really aspired to do. And I hadn't grown up knowing who Mario was. I grew up in Ohio. He wasn't a household name for us.
And for those listening, Emily's talking about the iconic American interior designer from the 1980s, Mario Botta, who is kind of known as the Prince of Chintz.
A friend of mine, one of my closest friends in New York, had worked for him for a long time, the longest. It's almost like getting on, Urban Cowboy, getting on one of those being at a rodeo, and how long can you stay on? I think that's what it was like being one of his assistants.
That's so funny.
She had managed to stay on for a long time. So I got to know about him, and then I met him, and he wrote the foreword actually to the first book I had written for the dealer.
Was he buying through the dealer, or you met through your friend? And then
the dealer had a PR person, Marilyn White, who is very good friends with Mario. And so course, Mario knew the dealer, but it wasn't one of his go-to places for shopping. So he wasn't just coming in normally. So Marilyn kind of made it happen. Mm-hmm. But what I understood as I started to study his work is that we both loved the English country house style. And I am obsessed with John Fowler, Nancy Lancaster, that I think if you're really in design, we all have one of those books that when we want to do something for ourselves, we go to and we look through and like, okay, how do they solve that problem? Yeah. Or what color, you know, like what kind of curtain did they do in that kind of window? And so the Chester Jones Colfax and Fowler book was one I had been going to, you know, to my late 20s onwards.
Mm-hmm. It's one of the first design books I ever bought. I feel like it's like a formative book for people in the industry.
It's one of those books. I was listening to your interview with Mika, and she, the Min Hogg book was one of her favorites. And I remember discovering that book as well. And there's a chapter, I know it's not called like Messy People, but it's a chapter on where everything is like so undone.
It's like it's like clutter kind of, but not.
Exactly. And that was so radical to see that sort of enshrined in this beautiful, huge book. And it's like, I see myself, you know, I saw myself in that chapter. And so when Rizzoli approached me about would I want to be considered for writing, helping Mario write his book, by that time, I was like, well, that's an honor because he's somebody who has actually deserves a book, has such a body of work, and, you know, has been in business for over 50 years. And I love what he loves. So this will be a treat. And I remember Alison Levasseur, who her family is actually a client of Mario's and she's known him forever, considered him like an uncle. She said to me after that book came out, she said, this is like the biggest thing you've ever done. And inside I was like, no, it isn't. You know, like I find Madeleine Castaigne books pretty amazing but little did I know how becoming part of Mario's world would change my life. You know, it's kind of crazy. And now it's just, he's always kind of with me. And I'm always thinking like, what would, you know, forget Chester Jones, you know, what would Mario do? It's wild the journey I've been on. And the biggest turn or change up is now I'm now designing.
Yeah, I saw that, which is amazing. And you have your gallery space too.
Yes, yes. And like I'm finding designing really easy, which I can't believe. And the gallery space came about, which is not something, I never wanted to be an entrepreneur, never wanted to build something, but it came out of, for two reasons. One was necessity. At the 10-year mark of working for this dealer, I was like, okay, it's time to move on. And 10 years is a good amount of time. And so,
yeah, that's a long amount of time, especially in the interiors industry.
And today, I mean, you stay somewhere for 6 months and, you know, it used to be like,
The turnover, I feel like is just so different now from what it was even 10 years ago.
Yeah, it's a very different attitude. So it was 10-year mark and I had a new book that I had just gotten a contract with for Rizzoli. I had some classes at FIT. I had just gotten an assignment to write an article for the Wall Street Journal. I'm like, okay, like I've got enough in the hopper. It's going to take off. You know, like this is this new sort of like freelancing, cobbling things, writing and teaching, it's going to work. And every single one of those things fell through after I left. And it was like, okay, what now? And so, yeah. So I fell back on, it's like, well, I have all this knowledge about antiques and selling antiques. And so I went back to that, you know, didn't necessarily want to, wasn't my dream. So I was on for Stibs. I was selling things. I just thought, this is the new way. You don't actually, because after being, you know, in retail jail, as they call it, like every time I had to go to the bathroom, I'd have to tell everybody, you know, just not like having freedom.
Right.
It's like, I don't want that. I'm not replicating that. I'm going to sell things on for Stibs. And this will just like augment everything else I'm doing. But then people would want to see the things in person. And I remember thinking, oh my God, I need a space that, you know, they can't come to my house, like my little shoebox apartment in Brooklyn and like come see a chandelier.
And it's such a beautiful space too. And I feel like you've created a community around the physical space. Like, you have great events and you do your annual holiday party. And it's such an interesting kind of offshoot of how you interact with decorative arts, but in a different way.
It's really snowballed over time. And so I had this little room and I had a party, and I remember a designer came and he's like, oh, I want to, you know, like the next day after the party, he's like, I want to see what you have. And I had like three things in the room. And I realized, okay, I've got to make these walls. I can't just wait around for people wanting to make appointments. Yeah. I've got to like something here for them to see. So that's when I started doing shows. And then it was sort of like, oh, I can tell stories without actually having to write a book. Because as you know, I mean, I find writing excruciating. And
really? That's so fascinating.
Oh, I find it so painful. Probably what I'm most proud of, you know, and like put, and I love the research part of it.
Yeah.
That's what I love. But it's like, I don't have to write a book about everything, you know, and I don't have to spend, you know, years with something. I can just do a little show and move on. And then as I started working more with creators, it really brought back my childhood of growing up with a single mother who, she's a potter and wildly unsuccessful, but wildly talented. And she would drag me, you know, when I was like 10, 12 years old, we'd like put on prairie dresses and go to these weird little shows to sell her ceramics. And seeing how hard it was for her to sell her own things that were so incredibly made, so underpriced, I didn't realize until the past 5 years when I've really shifted just my little room to show things into more of a gallery-like space, how much of that is my mission too, to help creators, like how much it means to me to help other people get their things out into the world.
Absolutely. And that makes so much sense. It also makes so much sense how you kind of ended up in the field that you're in, knowing that background. I mean, you must have kind of been ensconced in the arts from a young age without even consciously realizing it.
It's so true. And it's funny when you do the Sotheby's program, there it's divided up into modules. So there's a furniture module, a ceramics module, modern art, old masters. And I hated the ceramics module. And I think it was because my mother was always down in the basement, you know, in her studio. And I was just like, ugh, you know, but now I've come to really appreciate ceramics. But it's funny how all these, I mean, they say, think about what, when you were little, what did you naturally gravitate towards doing?
Yeah.
And I remember, for many years, we lived way out in the country in Michigan, and I would be by myself a lot. And I would create these little books, these like little coffee table books, actually with like little pictures. And
that's amazing.
And it's kind of like, you know, when you think back to those memories and you see how you're still connected, you found your way back to that and didn't even realize it. It's like, oh my God, it gives you chill bumps.
Yeah, it's so true. And that's something that we've been talking about. We talked a lot about that in season one. With a lot of the guests who came on, everybody kind of had those formative experiences with design and with art and architecture. And everybody sort of said, you know, at a very young age, it was something that they, whether consciously or, you know, subconsciously were interested in. So I'm always kind of fascinated by that. I was the same way. I was always taking art classes, and I actually thought I wanted to be a fashion designer when I was really little, like in elementary school. And my mom always kind of encouraged it. And I think that a part of it too is, you know, the people around you when you're younger are kind of encouraging that interest in the arts.
I think it's such a gift to be connected, to be able to be connected to that natural inherent interest.
It is.
And have it nurtured by your environment. It's really a gift. And a lot of people, you maybe have found this way. I think especially in the mid-20s is a really hard moment in time for a lot of people with like post-school. And it's like, is this all there is? Yep. And so many people don't have that connection to what they naturally love. And when you have it, it's hard to understand how, I mean, it's not a given that you're going to have a natural drive towards something.
Totally. And it might not be what you studied in school, but you end up finding your way back to it. So it's very interesting. When you went to school for decorative arts history, were you interested in like history first? Was it design first? Or you were always sort of finding yourself loving design?
It's such, I mean, that's such a great question. My major in college was Latin, if you can believe it.
Interesting. That's like Madeline Luckall, who was on. Also, she studied the classics as well.
And it mainly was, I had taken Latin in high school and I loved it, but it essentially was, I wanted to be comparative literature and I was studying Latin and German and then the German, and I don't have, I've always had a little bit of issue with hearing. And the German professor who was actually German, she's like, "You're not good at languages, are you?" So forget comparative literature. I'm just going to stay with Latin. And then I go to Rome for a semester and study. So that was, it was part of a just, you know, and it's sort of like a liberal arts education. I don't even think it matters what you major in. It's just about learning how to think critically.
Absolutely. Being exposed to different things.
Yeah, just being exposed to everything. And I mean, I do sometimes, I went to Oberlin, which has a really great art history program. Yeah. And I do wish, oh, why wasn't I an art history major? But my first instinct was actually fashion, kind of like you. And in college, I had an internship at Elle magazine in New York. And when I was in Paris as an au pair, I was also interning for Hearst for their fashion magazines. They shared an office, Town and Country, Harper's Bazaar. Mm-hmm. And I was like the president of every club in high school, not in high school, in college. And so when I got to Paris, I just wanted to go to nightclubs every night.
Just relax.
That interfered with my interning schedule during the day. So I ended up not interning. But what I found, and I think Madeline, somebody else said this on one of your other interviews, fashion people are tougher than design people. I found a lot of the people I was surrounded by nasty. And that is something that is kind of a conscious mantra of mine now, that I only want to be surrounded by and work with people I really like.
Yeah. And I think the interior community, the interior design community is as a whole very welcoming and collegial, I think.
I agree.
I interned at a bunch of places in fashion when I was in college. I interned at Teen Vogue and Chanel and Prada and all these places. And I ended up totally pivoting and got my master's in public affairs.
Whoa, talk about a reaction.
Yeah, it was so different. So I think that dovetails perfectly into talking about your new book that you wrote about Mario, which before we started recording, I was saying the new book about Mario feels so different from the original, which is a compliment. And they're both absolutely wonderful and both, I think, serve different purposes. So you've authored two books on him. Tell me a little bit about your newest book and the experience of working on books in general.
Thank you so much for saying that the second book is different, because it was the same editor, the same book designer who worked on the first book with Mario. And we all wanted it to have a very different feel. And I think you need both of the books, to be honest, like they both to really understand.
They're like a volume. Yeah. They're like a two volume series.
Exactly. And the first book is huge. It's over 400 pages and it has almost every single project that he ever did in it. And so a lot of people were like, well, what's going to be in the second book? Like everything's in the first book. So it's the first book is Mario in a nutshell. He was an entertainer and he wanted the book to entertain you. He really was self-made, even though my book really shows that he did have major influences and mentors along the way that helped steer him. But compared to other people, he didn't have education, really. He had like a couple semesters at college. He didn't have family money to float him or to help him start his business. He really, everything he achieved on his own. But he didn't want, that wasn't his message. He wanted it to look effortless. He wanted you and his clients to smile and feel good and feel beautiful. And that's what the first book is. It's just magic. But the question that fascinated me was, how did he get to where he got?
Right.
You know, like growing up in this immigrant like second generation immigrant family where nobody had really gone to college. And, you know, and he becomes this like super fancy society decorator when he has like Mariah Carey and Barbara Walters.
I know. It's like a movie. They really need to make a movie about him.
It's really interesting. And also the 80s were all about people wanting, you know, like this new money, wanting an instant pedigree. And they would go to him to create, and as well as other people, create an instant look of heritage. And going to somebody, unlike Sister Parrish, who had all the pedigree in the world, he didn't, you know, but he knew how to create it. Yeah. And so that story was so interesting to me. And that was a story he would not allow to be told in the first book. And also, how did he do things? Like what, how did he approach a room? Unlike Albert Hadley, and I've talked about this a lot, you know, Mario did not mentor other people. And he did have a little bit of a chip on his shoulder about him not having been helped so much. So he's not going to help his young assistants when they want to move on. If he found out an assistant who had left him went to one of his workrooms, he would be furious and he would forbid the workroom to work with that assistant.
Wow. So he kept it very close to the vest.
Close to the vest. So I wanted to crack it open. What I didn't anticipate, like I always knew the second book was going to happen after the first book, you know, like one day I will return to do this part of Mario's story.
Yeah.
What I didn't anticipate was how close I would become to him. I didn't know after we finished the first book, would we still be friends, you know?
Right.
And I didn't anticipate that I would be like his main like healthcare taker care of in the last months of his life and be entrusted by his brother to sell off everything in the estate, and which meant also clearing it up and like touching every single thing he owned and making the decision, does this get thrown away? Do we keep this?
Right. I mean, from a decorative arts history perspective, I mean, what a seat to be in.
Oh my God. It became such an emotional process that,
yeah,
but also maybe, you know, thinking like, okay, I know this book, we're going to do this book, and maybe we can create archives that could be donated somewhere. So you're like, do you throw this away? Like how revealing is this one piece of paper? And then right. As everybody knows now, he was like a hoarder situation. So it's not just everything is in file cabinets going through, it's that you have mountains that you're excavating.
I'm sure. Well, I feel like it's such an emotional, it's not like a typical profile or biography because of the relationship that you had.
100%. I just wrote this Instagram post yesterday that I, for the first time, like this is the 6th year, I feel like I've done my duty towards him. And the one thing that meant the most to him was being known and seeing his name in print. And I really, you know, I've said it a few times. I just don't want his name to be forgotten.
Yeah.
And I feel like I've done it. Like I've done what I can do.
Yeah, I absolutely believe that. I mean, I think the first book is a very polished tome that's very in depth and it has every project. And then the second book, I think, gives you a little bit more color on him as like a designer and a human and how he approached things. So I think the two together really, it gives you a full picture.
Well, thank you.
Yes, yeah. Hope.
I'm sure I'll go back in 5 years like, oh, you know, we missed all this, or, you know, like nothing is ever complete. And
yeah, well, it's hard not to pick apart your own work. I do that all the time.
Yeah.
What's your favorite thing about working in the decorative arts in general?
It's not precious. You're working with the fabric of your everyday life. I probably ripped off some advertisement saying that. But it's why shouldn't everything around you, and I think this is what I sort of picked up in France, why shouldn't everything around you be beautiful and useful? And that's what the decorative arts to me are. Like right. For me, a painting on the wall isn't superior or more important than a chair. To me, it all contributes equally to the environment, to the vignette, to a room. And so, yeah, I do think the decorative arts, they're never going to be taken as serious, you know, never esteemed as highly as fine art, quote unquote.
Right.
But to me, I mean, I guess that's part of what my gallery is about, is showing it all together. And so that's why I do have abstract expressionist paintings, but it's not as, I'm not saying it's more important than the 18th century console table I have beneath it, but just showing it all goes together.
Right. They're kind of curated in a way that makes sense for the story you're trying to tell.
Exactly.
Is there, because you also do some design work as well, is there a design rule that you always follow, or do you think that their rules are made to be broken?
Ooh. You know, I have some wonderful clients. They are really fantastic. And I would say the one thing that I have learned, this isn't really a rule, so I know I'm kind of like going off the rails with your questions, but what you're making me think of is Mario, when he first started, he was like, I'll do anything a client wants. You want chrome and glass? I can do it. I personally prefer Colfax and Fowler, but I'll do whatever they want. So that was like the 60s. He was like that. He started his firm in 1963. By the mid 70s, he's like, this is what I do. You know, and he fully was like, bows, dog paintings, like, yeah. Come to me, that's what you're going to get. And that's when he clicked with success. And when he was known for something in particular.
Yeah. I think because when you have like a point of view, people tend to come more for that.
That's exactly right. So the clients that have come to me are ones who love what I love. And I would never, if somebody did come to me and said they wanted like a Zen monastery beige room, I would say, you know what? I'm not for you.
We do that too. I agree with you. I think it makes the client process easier and more seamless.
Yeah.
Every space needs to reflect the owner. But if someone's coming to you for something that's so outside the box of what you do, you know, sometimes I just don't think it's the right match.
100%. And there would have been a time in my career when I would have said, yes, of course I can do it. And it's because I would have needed the work and I would have been like, I can figure it out. And there's sort of an ego thing, like, well, of course I could figure it out. But I think it's so great to be at the point where you can say no, when you can really hone in and whatever you do naturally love. And if you're more aligned with the client's taste, I think the success is so much more guaranteed.
Absolutely. I agree with that 100%. And it is fun to be pushed outside the box a little bit, but the trust has to be there on both sides for it to work. Is that some of the best advice for, you know, designing interiors that you've received, you think?
The best advice that I've sort of gotten through the people I have studied is the most important thing is getting the architecture of the room correct before you do anything else. So as much as you're able to modify it, that it needs to be modified, where, you know, are the baseboards too skimpy or the crown molding too skimpy, or, you know, do you need to move a wall? If you're able to do those things,
right,
that is money better spent than anything else.
Absolutely. I've listened to a lot of interviews with Bunny Williams, and she always says that too. I think the architecture is definitely the big starting point.
It is. It is. And it's sort of like when you buy a house and you have to do all this unsexy stuff that you don't see, maybe that's what it feels like to get the architecture correct, but it makes
a difference. It definitely does. Well, in terms of home, what do you think your home says about you?
I think people fall into two camps. And one is they want their home to be almost like a hotel room. They just want it serene, decluttered, yeah, zen. And I don't know if it connects with being an extrovert versus being an introvert. I'm more introverted, but I need, and Mario is like this too, I need my home to be stimulating. So I'm in a room right now that has these sort of like verdigris, turquoise walls and porcini and leopard velvet. And like, I need lots of stimulation, lots of pattern, lots of color.
That's such an interesting connection with introvert and extrovert. I never thought about that.
It could be completely wrong.
It's interesting though. I like that.
I actually do love to be with people and I love to be out, but it doesn't charge me up. It depletes me after a while. So I do need to come home.
Yeah.
And like right now it's January. I've been thinking about this month all year long. I get to be in Maine and I'm in a little village. I don't know how to drive. I won't see people for days on end. And I love it.
That sounds so relaxing, honestly.
Amazing. It's amazing. So I look forward to this month all year, you know, and I have my turquoise walls and lots of beautiful things to look at. So I couldn't do it in a gray box, you know,
yeah,
that kind of thing. And things around me have meaning to me. I have a lamp here that I just brought back from Cressida Bell, who I just did a show of.
The show was great. It was so I was following it on Instagram. Beautiful.
Oh my God. Thank you. I'm just so excited to be working with her. And
yeah, she's so talented.
She's so talented. And, you know, little things by artists I work, like everything has a story and means something to me. So I guess in a way it's revealing, you know, it's a
yeah,
in a way.
I love that. Are there any favorite places that you have to shop for home?
I mean, I love buying at auction. And I think that's the thing when you really, when you have the trained eye and you are,
yeah,
that's the best place to buy.
It's thrilling. It's just so fun when you win something that you absolutely love and were holding out hope for. I think it's like one of the best thrills.
Oh my gosh, I love it. So like live auctioneers, and then you can you save your alerts. So that's one of my favorites. There's a dealer, it's Hampton and Company, started by this guy, Michael Hampton, who was a DC decorator. And then he opened up a shop in Maine. And everyone's like, oh, are you furnishing your house from Maine Antiques Dealers? And it's like, no, because I have a very formal, like Spanish colonial house, which isn't made for like rustic Americana furniture.
Yeah.
But he has the most high style. Prices are amazing. So it's always a treat to like on our way up here to stop by and see what Michael has. And it's this tiny,
I love that.
Just loaded with treasures. So that's like a fix. Oh my God. And buying topiaries, you know, going to my friend Anthony Belomo shop orangery. I mean, incorporating plants in a room to me is, it's probably one of the most important layers a room can have and is transformative. Yeah. Transformative.
Brings it life.
Yeah, exactly.
I've been dying to go to Orangerie. We are hoping to go in the spring. We're going to do a big Millbrook day and we're going to go visit.
Oh my God, you're going to have so much fun.
I know. I'm excited. We're going to bring the whole team.
Go with a trailer so you can just load it up.
I know. We're taking a little AOI field trip up to Millbrook. It's so
That's
fun.
That's really fun.
What do you think have been the three biggest influences on your aesthetic in your life?
I would definitely say the work of John Fowler and Nancy Lancaster. Just seeing photographs of all of Nancy Lancaster's houses. Mm-hmm. Would I say old Hollywood movies?
Yeah.
Or would I say old fashioned magazines?
Well, those are three right there. I love that.
Watching movies like Auntie Mame and The Women and, you know, Fred Astaire and Ginger Roger movies, the sets, and oh, like Douglas Sirk movies. Oh my God. Like those are.
I mean, they're transportive. And you also, those sets are just, you can learn so much from them. I remember in the Ralph Lauren documentary, he says that he's so inspired by movies from the 30s. And I think it's like an underrated source of inspiration in our industry.
It really is. And it's when you think, because Mario would always talk about how he was trying, he wanted to create like a backdrop, like a cinematic backdrop for his clients to live against. And that he really saw mm-hmm. them as sort of actors in their own movie. When you see a set design, like it's not like how we live with socks, you know, like a basket of laundry waiting to be carried up.
Like normal people.
It's all so careful and deliberate and usually a little bit fashion forward.
Just trying to convey something about, you know, about the characters and.
Exactly. And there's an intention to make it attractive to the eye. And like Nancy Meyers movies.
Absolutely. And they tie into the characters. Like you can tell how much thought went into the sets and the costumes because when you. I mean, I watch them, those movies all the time and you pick up something new every time because it's, you know, it's a reflection of who she's trying to get you to understand.
That's right. And really seeing, and I think this is, we're in such a really interesting visual era of social media where everybody can be their own brand and broadcast. You know, they understand the power of what they're wearing and what their backdrop is. So I think people are now aware than ever about the telling people things because of a certain wallpaper behind them or something like that.
Well, we have our rapid fire questions at the end, which we love to ask everyone. They're not necessarily design focused, but they kind of, I feel like they give everybody a full picture. So the first question is, what is your favorite food?
Oh my gosh. You know, I think I would probably say something pasta, but I've just had it for like 20 meals in a row and it's like, not pasta. Do you know what I mean?
Pasta is definitely one of my favorites. I feel like it's like universally comforting.
Yeah. So it would probably be like my husband makes this incredible carbonara. That would be probably at the top.
That feels like it deserves to take top place. Favorite drink?
Aperol Spritz.
Oh, I love an Aperol Spritz, especially when it's hot out. It's so refreshing.
It is.
Speaking of films and sets, favorite film?
Okay. It isn't for the sets, but it's, I hate watching movies over again. But the one movie I probably, beside from The Sound of Music, which I had to watch every single day when I was an au pair, I would say the one I've seen the most is The Devil Wears Prada. I just love that movie. I could watch it.
Oh, that movie. I have such a place in my heart for that movie. That made me want to move to New York and work in fashion.
Okay, Ariel. Now that's...
I know. It's not like, you know, I'm from outside of Philadelphia, so it was very glamorous to watch that.
Yes, yeah. So that's one. I mean, I would say for set decoration, you know, I would love to, okay, this is because I'm pretentious. I would love to say something like The Umbrellas of Cherbourg or something like that, you know, which is really exciting. But like what I would watch over and over again is The Devil Wears Prada.
Favorite hotel?
I mean, I love not staying there because it's in New York, but I love the Carlisle for... Yeah. Cafe Carlisle.
It's so iconic.
Yeah. So I would say from that point of view, there aren't many hotels I actually like staying in. It's more like I like going to have brunch there. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that does make sense. Okay. I feel like when you're a creature of comfort and you like being in your own space, it's always a bit disorienting staying in a hotel.
Yeah.
Well, favorite city?
I would say in terms of another city that I could live in, it would be London.
Yeah.
It's also because of the people there too. It's not just because of the city itself. For pure aesthetic value, I would probably, you know, go with Paris or Rome.
I always say if we ever moved outside of the States for a little bit, I would want to live in London. My husband lived there as a kid for a couple of years and he always says what a formative experience it was living somewhere outside of the States. And what a beautiful place to live as a kid, I feel like.
Oh, yeah. How wonderful.
Okay. This is when we ask everyone, because I feel like people in the industry have such strong preferences, bedding.
Oh, yeah. Porto, 100%. And my husband hates it.
It's so funny. Men are very 50-50.
Oh, he hates it. And he'll go to Target and we have Porto towels also. And he'll just buy, Target's wonderful and you can get great stuff there. But he'll just like the nastiest brown, like pale brown, hard towels. Man. And like, I don't know.
That's so funny. It's like an opposite visceral reaction to having beautiful Porto towels.
Yes. And then also I read something in the Times about how it's apparently very Scandinavian to have separate bedding on your beds. Like you have, so we have a king bed, but like I have my own blankets and sheets and he does as well. So it's like,
oh, interesting.
The bottom sheet's Porto, but like what is on his side is like ugly brown and tan and mine is all, you know, Porto and beautiful.
Yeah, that's so funny.
It's great to not share blankets. It's really nice.
Well, tea or coffee, and how do you take it?
Espresso, quad shot on ice with about an inch of whole milk.
Oh, I love that. I love a specific order. I just think it's so interesting to me. Favorite playlist?
Okay. My friend, Michael Diaz-Griffith, and his husband, Alonso, have this Spotify playlist called Neo Disco.
Ooh, I have to check it out. I love his book.
Yeah. Oh, I love it too.
New Antiquarians. It's a great book.
So I'm off that used to be a go-to, but sometimes you can go too often. Who I really love listening to is Jessie Ware. She's my like go-to. I don't know if you know her music, but it's this.
No, I'll have to check it out.
Like disco funk. It has this retro vibe to it. And I love to dance. So it's like really upbeat. And yeah, I highly recommend Jessie Ware.
I love it. Favorite weekend activity?
Oh my gosh. I mean, okay. I love watching. So this is like so classic. Like while my friends Chris and Anthony are gardening their butts off, I'm watching gardening on television. Gardener's World with Monty Don. And
yeah, it's so relaxing.
It's so relaxing. So there's a new episode every weekend. So it's like, it's such a treat to like just sit and have my coffee and watch Monty Don. And it's,
that's what I feel about the Create Academy gardening classes. They're like so beautifully produced. They're so peaceful. I like to watch those too. They're very relaxing. And then this is our last take 10 question, but I feel like I can't even ask you this. What's your favorite design book?
Oh my God.
I know. It's like not fair. I can't even ask.
I mean,
you.
I have to say, I love that Chester Jones, you know, I can't remember the name of it, but it, you know, the Colfax and Fowler book. That's
just, yeah, I can picture it. It's got like the roses on it.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. So that's still my go-to, I would say, being inspired.
Yeah. That's a great book. When I did my first show house room, I did Holiday House in 2018, actually. I had the first Mario book there in the room. And I also had the Colfax book that we were talking about in the room.
Oh my God, I love that.
Yeah. Well, a final few words. What are you working on right now? Are there any new projects you can talk about and tell us about?
I mean, you always have to have lots of irons on the fire. The new book is going to be on Robshawn Gibbings, T.H. Robshawn Gibbings.
Oh, interesting.
And his whole career, which was sort of modernizing classicism in the 20th century, particularly with his furniture collections for Widdicombe. Mm-hmm. I'm really, really excited about that.
That'll be great.
And then we're working on a project in LA. We're working on a project in the Middle East.
Ooh, cool.
Very excited to, whenever they're done, to be able to show those to everybody.
Yeah.
My house in Maine will be a project for a long time. So I'm excited to get going with doing garden design for that. And also we've been thinking, it's interesting that we've talked about the gallery today, but I think we're going to be shifting a little bit and making it even more of an immersive experience and taking kind of Colfax and Fowler's Yellow Room as an inspiration. Ooh. To do more. Here's a whole room, but it's all for sale kind of thing. So I think we're playing around more with the decorative arts in a living kind of atmosphere versus the more gallery-like to see how that goes. So
yeah, I can't wait to see it. That sounds so exciting. There's so much going on for you. Well, the parting question that we always ask everyone is, what advice would you have for someone looking to define their own interior style?
I would say, look at lots of pictures, books. What sings to you? Like what makes your heart pulse?
Yeah.
You know, like what, not like, oh, I think that's stylish, or people like that seems like what everybody thinks is cool, but what makes your heart beat fast?
Totally. I think that's such a good lesson in finding, you know, your own idiosyncratic style. Avoid thinking about what's cool or what's trendy or what would signify as stylish at that point in time, and just kind of gravitate toward what you think is personally cool to you.
Yeah. And that's how I wrote, like, it was seeing a picture of Madeleine Kestang's salon in her country house. When I first saw that image, a friend was like, oh, I think you would like, this would appeal to you. Oh my God, I had a heart attack.
Yeah, it's formative, those moments.
Henri Samuel's Winter Garden for Susan Goodfriend.
Yeah, that's
beautiful. Oh my God, you know, so, I mean, I don't think every room speaks to everybody in that way, but I mean, Ariel, for you, what was a room that you saw that you just died over?
Honestly, I have to say, La Fiorentina and the way the blue and white was used there.
Yeah.
is kind of formative for me. And I also think Oscar de la Renta's house in Punta Cana, those images are so beautiful.
And those are really of a piece. Like, I really see a thread between those two, too.
Yeah, yeah. There's sort of just like, there's a classicism, but a relaxed nature to it. And I think that's sort of what I'm always drawn to, is something that feels timeless, but it's not cluttered or necessarily maximalist, but it's still classic in a way. I think that's those two are big ones for me.
Love. Yes.
Well, where can listeners find more about you and your brand?
Oh, Ariel, thank you for asking. Follow us at Erdmann's New York, or come and visit us down in the village on 10th Street. We're at 14 East 10th Street. All the information's on our website, erdmannsnewyork.com. And we do two or three shows a year, but even in between, we always have something cooking. So part of our mantra every day is to be as welcoming and warm as possible. So we'd love to see you all.
For everyone listening, it's a fabulous space with fabulous things. So definitely check it out. Well, Emily, thank you so much for joining us. This was such a delight to get to chat with you.
Such a pleasure. Really, really a treat.
That's a wrap for this week's episode of Talk Shop. Thank you for listening. We'll be back next week with more thoughtful discussions and amazing guests. Make sure you follow on Apple Podcasts and on Spotify so you never miss an episode. And of course, follow me at Ariel Oaken. See you next week.